leader that defines the way. Find yourself and others with strategic change. This is The Path to Success. Broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Growth Matters.
Well, good morning. It's another hopefully sunny day here in Atlanta, and we are here for another edition of Growth Matters. And today we have a family affair to talk a little bit about. We have two representatives from Colgate Mattress. And probably for all you parents out there that have babies and have had to buy crib mattresses, you're familiar with their name. But Colgate Mattress is a family-owned business, and it was started in 1955, and I'm going to let our guest today tell you a little bit more about it. We have the president of Colgate Mattress, Alan Walken. So good to see you.
Thank you very much.
And also Dennis Walken, who is the national sales manager for Colgate. So welcome.
Correct. Thank you.
So just to maybe start us off, since I sort of teed up this is a family affair, and we are going to want to understand a little bit about how that plays into your family as well as business. Alan, why don't you tell us a little bit about how this got started? It started with your parents, your father.
My father and my mother. My father served in World War II in the 8th Air Force, and their motto was "Can Do." And when he got out of the Army, the Air Force, he was looking for things to do. He actually ran a couple of textile manufacturing companies for other people. One of them making women's shoulder pads, which were very popular in the 50s. And he was working for his brother-in-law, but he didn't really like his brother-in-law's brother, and he said, "I need to do something on my own." He had a friend in the Bronx, because they were born in New York. So he went over there one day and said, "I'd like to do something for myself." And he says, "Well, why don't you make baby mattresses?" "So where am I going to do that?" And he said, well, and then that family actually had a mattress company in New York on Colgate Avenue in the Bronx. And since my father had a sister in Atlanta, he said, "Well, why don't we try Atlanta?" And these are pioneer days almost. You know, with no money, no job, no anything. He just moved his family to Atlanta and opened up in March of 1955. And for those of you that are familiar with Atlanta, on Ponce de Leon,
okay,
across from the old Sears, which is now probably the hottest area in town, across from the Ford factory and up the street from where the Atlanta Crackers used to play baseball. So anyway, he opened up. He actually sent for us 2 months later because he wanted to get started. And it was really a very, very hard struggle. I'm sure he almost gave up, but he was actually a smoker. He smoked 3 packs of Camels a day, non-filtered, because that's what the Army gave them in those days. And he realized after a month or so that this wasn't good for him. He didn't need doctors. He didn't need all kind of organizations telling him it wasn't good for him. He just knew it. So that's another lesson we learned from my father, his not only his honesty, integrity, hard work, motivation. He was just self-motivated. But once he said he was going to do something, he did it. Obviously, he almost gave up, like I said in the beginning, just getting customers and starting something new. It just
took out from there.
Correct. It took a while, and we remained on Ponce de Leon till about 1993, I believe. We actually there's like 3 buildings, and some of you might realize it's Paris on Ponce.
Right.
So as we grew, we doubled the size in 69, took over one of the buildings, and then there was a third building on Ponce de Leon Place. So we had everything but the corner. But because of traffic and business, we realized we needed to move. And we actually decided to move and keep the business in Atlanta a manufacturing company in Atlanta, which is kind of rare, and we surveyed all of the employees, and they wanted us to stay in Atlanta, and that's what we did. We didn't move way out to some, you know, a county far, far away. We wanted our employees to go with us.
So the entire time you've been in Atlanta?
In the city limits of Atlanta.
Wow.
And right now, so we moved to an area most of you know as Cabbage Town, which was not the greatest neighborhood at the time, but right now it is just booming. And we're in the middle of all this growth and development. We would like to say that we help.
You help start it off.
Yeah.
Dennis, as someone who, I guess, has known this story and been around with this, tell us a little bit about your background, and did you ever think about going to work anywhere else?
Sure. Actually, I did work somewhere else after college. I went to work for Procter & Gamble for a little while and then eventually came back. I always, in high school, was encouraged to have other jobs as well as summer jobs at the factory. But I'll tell you, working in the factory was a lot harder than any of the other jobs.
Yeah, so you kind of, you did that, but you also have kind of grown up in different parts of the business. You're the national sales manager right now.
Correct. National sales manager just means I get to load a truck every now and then as well.
Oh, good.
But I brought my son in a couple of weekends ago because we work on the weekends sometimes, and brought him in, and he's 7, and I realized I had him doing the first job my grandmother ever had me doing, and that's counting coins.
Wow.
From the junk machine.
Wow.
So I've always been in it. I thought eventually I would always come back.
Wow.
And we're glad to have him, by the way.
Well, I have to think that getting to start with any company at the ground level and working your way up, you gain a lot of respect of the employees, and it's also really big on character building. How's that been for you?
It's actually been good. I mean, I'm not going to tell you it was easy during the summers, but then again, nowadays, if I have to ask somebody to do something, chances are I've done it at some point, and same thing with my father.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, down from cleaning the bathrooms to unloading trucks. He's done it all. So,
yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about sort of your specialty and your product line. It's my understanding that many of the companies that make crib mattresses make adult mattresses as well, but you focus, Alan, just on crib mattresses. So tell us a little bit about your product and why the focus in just that area?
I mean, it's an excellent question. Spread yourself too thin. You'll do a lot of things, but not one thing good. And we found a niche, I guess you would call it, and we could have made adult mattresses, but we liked making the baby mattresses. That's just kind of all I ever knew, but and thinking about it, we just wanted to make one better. There was a lot of, and there still is a lot of, one of the cardinal rules of business, you don't knock your competition, but there's a lot of mattresses I wouldn't put my own child on or grandchild. So we've remained in primarily the juvenile industry. We make other products that go along, such as mattresses for cradles or porta cribs, or we make a lot of dressing, what we call dressing table and changer pads. I guess a lot of, you know, it seems like not a lot to me, but it is. When I start thinking about the product line, it's pretty broad. But we want to. That's where our focus has been and continues to be, to build a better mattress from the inside out. When you go in a store, say if you're shopping for an adult mattress, you'll look at the most gorgeous fabrics you've ever seen, but it's not what's on the outside. It's what's on the inside that counts, because that's where your baby, your precious baby, is depending on you as the parent to provide them the best that they can buy.
Definitely. Well, could you educate our listeners, just because I'm sure I've never heard of a baby mattress before, and I would not know it even really existed. What are the benefits, and why should you really stick to that for your child? What are the health benefits for that?
Well, when your baby, up until 6 or 9 months, your baby's in that bed, it could be almost 18 hours a day.
Wow.
So you want the support, you want the comfort, and you want the security. That crib, no matter what, there's a lot of beautiful cribs out there, but the basic rectangular crib, is they all look alike. They might have some fancy wood or different colors, nice fabrics hanging from the wall, but they are sleeping on the same rectangular surface, which is approximately 27 and a half by 52, which is a national standard. So any mattress can fit in anyone else's crib.
Okay.
So you look for the support, firmness, hopefully, and you'll get longevity. And usually what happens is most people will keep the mattress through all the babies, and then they'll turn around and give it to their sister.
That's how great it is. It's a great investment.
Right. Yeah. Even we make all price ranges, but we feel we make the best. And we have our own testing facility that shows that ours will last longer upon baby jumping. You know, eventually those babies,
they grow, don't they?
They do grow. And they
rapidly.
And they talk back.
They do. I don't know how that happens.
Speaking of talking back, can I jump in a little bit?
Definitely.
He mentioned the testing. And one of the things we always want to be ahead of is the testing. And when we know the firmness is one of the most important things in the durability and the longevity of the mattress. When we went to the different testing labs, nobody had a test. So we actually developed our own test. And it's basically a 300-pound toddler with insomnia jumping up and down for 8 hours in a day, which simulates, according to us, three children and toddlers using the mattress for the lifespan of the mattress.
Wow.
And what we do is you measure how flat and firm it stays. And we called it the Colgate Challenge, and we challenge any one of our competitors to do this test. We applied for a patent for the test in a neutral area so far, and no one's even bothered to contact us about any details. But when we showed it off at the last trade show, people really, they said, we always knew you guys had the best, but this really shows it off.
So. That's really forward thinking of you guys to get ahead of that, because I think everyone's going to be following that trend of, okay, now we have to find out and get tested and have these kind of metrics.
Correct. And, you know, when people come to us and ask, here's a new material we've got, here's a new filling material, we want to test it out and make sure it's going to be good, because I can say anything I want is the best, but, you know, define that. So we feel we've defined the quality.
So, Dennis, tell us a little bit about sort of your growth trajectory. So you were talking, we were talking before we started with one way that you were able to grow. So tell us a little bit about the history and how you've been able to continue to stay in business so long.
Well, you know, one thing about my father and my grandfather and my uncle, and they work extremely hard. I mean, this is their hobby as well as their job and career. And they're able to work in such a positive way and work so hard that they're the best at what they do. And that sets a good example. You can talk about role models all you want, but when you see it, you know, sure. It's a great way to learn. And when I was growing up, you know, I saw that, and then I wanted to go to work with my daddy, just like my son wants to go to work with me. They don't want to go to school. They want to work.
I love it.
Actually, maybe off topic, but when Dennis told me that we were going to be here, you know, and how did it start and what are the experiences, I mean, it really touched some heartstrings, because, you know, I've lived it, and it made me think about my father a lot lately. Now, he passed away 3.5 years ago, and, I mean, up until the last month, he would come in. I mean, since he retired maybe 10, 12, maybe longer, a long time, 20 years ago maybe, but he would come in every Saturday, and he would look at the he would get the weekly reports. He would see the accounts receivable, accounts payables. And he, in an instant, he could figure out how we were doing, what we were doing wrong, et cetera. But to have an advisor like that is just like
invaluable.
Any yeah. president having his quote-unquote kitchen cabinet. I just so there's just a lot of random thoughts, and if I'm a little off what we're talking about or digress, you'll have to forgive me. But you know, when you've lived it all these years, and I think the first lesson I learned was on Ponce de Leon, our front of our store, quote unquote. We're not a store; we're just manufacturers. So again, it was a summer. You know, we'd work after school or in the summer. So my first time going down. My father takes me outside on Ponce de Leon Avenue. He hands me a broom. And I said, well, what's that? He says, it's a broom. I said, what do I do with that? He says, you sweep the sidewalk every morning. So these kind of things are ingrained in you. And my mom, I mean, she was as, you know, in those days, it was mom and pop, even on a manufacturing company. And she was the secretary and the bookkeeper. And I have to say, she was a legal secretary all during the war, the big war. And so when she went to help my father, I mean, she was the stenographer. She did stenography, and most people don't even know what that is now, but legal secretary. So she could take down whatever you said as fast as you could talk. She had all the little dicks and ducks and so forth. Anyway, long story short, so she had her. I only wish I had the old Royal typewriter that she had, but she was the fastest person I ever saw. So one day when we upgraded to the IBM Selectrix, so I would go by. I went by her office and she was just so upset. I said, "Mom, what's the matter? What's the matter?" She said, "This machine is too slow for me." So.
Well, I'm curious, you saying it is a family affair, and a lot of businesses don't necessarily make it through the generations. I mean, they might be very strong with the founder, and even if it's still a part of the family legacy, that doesn't always guarantee success. So, Dennis, as somebody who's watching sort of the generations, what is it that you think has sort of the secret sauce that allows your firm to keep at the same level of quality and even innovating through the generations?
Well, I think the secret sauce is the guidance that my uncle and father and grandfather and grandmother gave us to, it's okay to try something new and different as long as you stick to the main qualities of a quality product. And one thing he told me was, you know, you listen to your customers. Listen to your customers. You don't have to do everything they say, but you do need to listen to them because they're the ones that are dealing with the consumers. They're on the front lines, and they are your bosses, not him.
Do you have a particular method that helps you stay close to your customers so that you are able to see trends and you're able to continue to innovate?
It's not so much as a method, but we do have the one set meeting we try to have every week is a production meeting. And you can think of terms of a regular production meeting, but to us, it's not just going over the orders. We look at who's ordering it and why and how is their business doing. And, you know, we have a pretty personal relationship with a lot of our customers if we have for many years. And so between listening to your customers, sticking to your core values, but not being afraid to try something new.
Alan, you know, a lot of people sit in your shoes and talk with Kevin and I each week. And as I think about it, Kevin, not a lot of them are necessarily manufacturers, and particularly not in the city limits of Atlanta. So what was the thing that kept you in Atlanta? I mean, as you began to grow, you could have made other choices. And what was it that made you stay in the heart of Atlanta? And today, what's one of your biggest challenges that you have continuing to manufacture within the city limits?
I guess because of the family, I didn't want to move out of Atlanta. At one time, there were three other factories in Colgate. One was in New York, one was in Houston, one was in Pittsburgh. But eventually, we took over all the territory, and we wanted to remain together as a family. Maybe we should have moved, you know, expanded out to the West Coast or something. We've looked at it, believe me. But I guess we all wanted to kind of be together. Now, of course, that actually adds to your transportation costs. But we felt that we could produce enough here and keep ahead of the schedule to ship all of our customers all over the country. And we've been able to do that. If you put in a lot of our other companies in our industry, I'm not just talking baby, that they have distribution centers, but we want to control our whole everything from the purchasing to the quality to the inventory control, shipments, and so forth. And we've been able to do it out of, you know, one location. I'm not sure I answered the whole question, no, right? But it, you kind of, it's. I guess I didn't want to move.
Well, but the other part of it is, you know, the city of Atlanta at the time when the decision to move came about, the Southeast was in full growth mode, and it still kind of is. The Southeast is adding population. Atlanta is such a transportation hub between the airport. You have three major interstates coming through. It's within a lot of the different population areas, has a educated workforce, and public transportation as well.
So that helps just the environment made it so that once you made the decision, you were able to stay. So it's my understanding that some of the ways that you've grown has been because some of your customers have grown. You were telling me a little story about really scaling up and having to really ramp up distribution. So for our listeners who maybe are in that type of situation where they've gotten their first big contract, how did you sort of make the transition from a smaller manufacturing crib manufacturer to the organization that you are today?
Well, it's always been part of the philosophy that you treat every customer like they're an important customer, whether it's one person with a 600-square-foot boutique or a chain of stores. Because, first of all, you never know when that 600-square-foot store is going to start to grow and grow and grow. And they'll hopefully remember that you treated them like an important customer. No one customer is much more important than the other, so that was part of it. And because we took care of people, they have tended to stay with us as they grow.
But tell our listening audience, as you've been able to maintain that relationship, when you have had to scale to meet new demand, how do you deal with those strategic issues? How were you able to keep that same level of quality and ramp up distribution and manufacturing in a significant way?
Well, we try to anticipate, and we try to buy as a larger company. So even though we're a smaller company in the mattress industry overall, we buy as a larger company. And that's one of the things that when particular stores were concerned, hey, we're opening more and more locations, can you keep up? We give them a plan that, yes, we can without a problem.
So, again, you guys are forward-thinking. You've thought ahead. You want to grow, and you anticipate the growth, so you're ready for it when they say, well, can you keep up? And you're already ahead of the game at that point.
We try to be, yes.
And we also try to take customer ideas and implement them. Somebody will come to us and say, well, I like this. Can you do it? And we don't just say, well, this is our line. It's expansive enough. Pick something out. If they want red and we only make it in blue, we'll find a way to make it in red or make it with their labeling or a particular focus that they would like. So, I mean, we've always worked with the customers, large or small, and like Dennis said, we treat them all the same. It's worked.
Yeah. So if you think back to when you started as president of the organization, I know that you've been around since 1955, but how long have you been the president, Alan?
A long time.
Okay. All right.
Well, that's another story. I don't hope you don't mind the stories, but you don't know how wonderful this is to talk about some of these things. But I guess I was there, I don't know, a couple of years. And I, whatever I was doing all the a lot of the grunt work and getting things moving, et cetera. And one day I said to my father, I said, you know, I kind of like a title. He says, well, pick one out. Doesn't cost me anything. So my first title was actually special accounts executive, because he did have a sales manager and he did have sales. So I was innovative. And eventually he decided that maybe he, when he was cutting back a little, that I should become the president. So that's what. So I've been it a long time. I don't even 30 years.
30? I'm always curious when you come into a family business, and even though you've had multiple responsibilities, I'd be interested in from both of your perspectives, but I'll start with you, Alan. How did you know that you could be a leader and have that forethought to take the business further and further? Was it just something that came naturally to you, or was there, you know, a story or a day that you knew, yeah, I can really continue to take this company in the direction that it needs to go?
Well, my father let us do whatever. He let us make our own mistakes, and it was no stringent rules other than, you know, make it right, do it at the right price, buy right, and treat your customers right. You don't gouge your customers. You charge a fair price, which we've always done. We just because we can maybe sell that chair for $100, but the folding chair only $10, you just don't try to make that one, you know, $50. You just charge a fair price, and that's worked for us. I've lost it. I don't know. Just
it's, in some ways, it came naturally because you were able to see.
We would see different products, different ideas were out there, and we thought we could implement them into our manufacturing. I mean, obviously, when we started out, we might have had four or five models, and when someone would come to us or they wanted something different than the store across town, said, fine, we'll make a different cover, we'll give you a different coil count, or we'll give you a different construction. We just did what the customers wanted, and we were able to satisfy different types of customers over the years.
Dennis, how about you? How did you know it was time and ready for you to come back and then that you could serve in the leadership role that you're playing?
I don't know if there was ever a specific moment, but when my grandfather died, all of a sudden my uncle and father were going to, you know, they were very worried about the business, and I said, don't worry, I think I can handle this, while they were mourning, as they should, you know, obviously. Obviously, I was mourning as well, but I kind of realized then that, you know, my dad had taught me well, my uncle had taught me well, and my grandparents as well. And, you know, from the other side of the family, they had started their own businesses too, and so I had learned from that as well. So it was never something where, I don't know if I can do this. It's just because, you know.
So tell us maybe a lesson or something that you learned about yourself now that you've served in this role, that as a part of being in this family-owned business, that you've learned about yourself personally.
That you have to learn to separate and put walls in terms of the business and your personal life. And it's tough at times because it is at times all we think about, you know, and you've got to learn to step back from it as best you can. So, and none of us ever went out and played golf for 4 hours on a weekend. He was working. That was his golf game. So, you know, it's not like that.
That's right.
So. How is it, Alan, working with your son and being able to create that separation, but yet still keep it all in the family?
Well, we have some of our tradition is we usually we started having breakfasts together on Sunday morning, and whoever shows up shows up. So it's expanded to my nieces and nephews, and you know, it gets to be a pretty. And that's one tradition my father wanted us to continue. We're not doing it as many Sundays in a row as we used to because there's now grandchildren, et cetera, et cetera. But he always stressed how important the family was. So, like one time when he was starting, it was pretty rough because his whole my mom and his family was they were all up in New York, and they would they couldn't go to some of the weddings and other family functions. And an old uncle that was here in Atlanta, my father was telling him, my uncle asked him, "How come you're not going up to New York for such and such?" And he says, "No, I just can't get away, and I don't really have the money." So they asked him, he says, "Are you going to, if so-and-so dies, are you going to go to the funeral?" And my father says, "Of course." He says, "If you're going to go to the bad things, you better go to the good things." So we always try to go to the good things. So if you have a big event, we'll come. we like the happy things.
Yeah. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about sort of the idea of technology and you talked about what makes your products different in this Colgate challenge. Talk to us a little bit about that technology and how it has an influence or how it plays in the way you manufacture and the way you develop products.
Well, it's a very fine line because the people we have working for us, a lot of them started working out from my grandfather and my father, and they're true craftsmen. I mean, they really are, and they're very, very good at what they do. In fact, the gentleman that's been cutting our material for over 30 years, we wanted to bring in a new cutting machine, which instead of doing it by hand like my grandfather did it, and we were doing it now, we started to look at different machines and one that could do almost what he could do. It'd never be as good as him, but it was the right step. So we tend to analyze it. Can the machine do it better, and can we train the person to do something else? You know, we don't want to lay somebody off because we brought in a new machine. So we have to balance it out between the people and the technology.
So do you have a planning process that helps you think about when it's time to bring in new technology or it's time to change your way of doing business? How does that genesis sort of work?
No, we look at it. We look at where we can improve the manufacturing and the lead time and the use of the different materials and where things slow down. And we always step back and take a look. And we analyze it in a couple of different ways like that.
Very cool. Well, I always love, we get to talk to people that are so passionate about their job, and that's just a real privilege. And how is it to actually do something that you're so passionate about? I mean, when you guys talk about it, I guess you guys don't get to have these kind of conversations very often.
We actually don't. No,
we don't have time.
Yeah, we really don't.
This is as long as we've been away, well, except during our trade shows.
Right, but...
But we have taken family vacations together, and that's very nice. But it's limited time period when we can do it. We close the factory basically two weeks a year from maintenance and inventory. But most of the people get off, and people that qualify for more time, you know, other will get other time during the year. But at least the factory's not closed down, so that's about the only time that the family can kind of get together. And we still get along, so we all go away together.
That's true. But also, now that you bring that up, one thing we try to do once a year is get the four of us, my uncle, my father, and my brother, myself, in a car. And we just start driving, and that's our board meeting. And we'll eventually stop at a hotel, and then we'll go on a run out in the desert, so to speak, and keep, you know, the phones are off, and we meet, talk about strategizing, what's our goals for the next year.
I love that.
But it's hard to do. It's, believe me, between all the other commitments, it's hard to pull the four of us. That's why we kind of need to do it. And
I love that.
Yeah. It shows that you're still committed to planning, but in a family type of environment, and so that you're keeping everybody connected. So, I am able to do a little bit about the math. So it looks like next year is a big year for you. You started in 1955.
In Atlanta, March of 1955.
And so if my math serves me correctly, that says that next year is 60?
That's right. Put her in the cutting room.
So as you think about next year, and, you know, one of the things Kevin and I are always interested in, because the name of the show is Growth Matters, you've had a lot of success and a lot of growth through the history, but how do you set that goal for that big growth for the next 60 years?
Well, you know, research and development was very important when my grandfather started the business. He introduced the modern-day crib mattress in the form of coils and foam, and today research and development is still important to be competitive. I mean, just because, you know, we came up with a lot of the firsts in this industry, we still want to mark that, and it's a fine line to not just look back, oh, we've been here forever, and, you know, that's that, because your competition can use that against you, too.
So R&D, you've mentioned that a couple of times. Talk to our listening audience about sort of how you balance that and how you're able to have the capital to be able to not only do the manufacturing and the distribution from your hub, but also to be able to continue to have the cash flow and the dollars to be able to put into R&D. How do you sort of balance that portfolio?
I just reach in his pocket. Well, it's a great question, because there are, you know, when we go to trade shows or we talk to our suppliers and say, what's new? Show us something that you're coming out with that we can be innovative with. You almost want to buy everything. You know, we were never, you know, shoppers going into, say, Neiman Marcus and shopping, but that what excites us is new machinery and new products. And so we don't borrow money. I mean, we just don't like to do that. While, yeah, my grandfather did start it with a small loan from his brother-in-law, other than that, we really don't borrow money.
So are you saying that for your 59-year history, with the exception of the first infusion of capital, that your business has grown through self-funding?
True.
Wow.
The first loan, I guess it's not a secret, but it was my father borrowed $1,500 from his brother-in-law, you know, 60 years ago. And he was very nervous that he couldn't pay it back. I mean, the dollar was a lot different back then, but still, whatever it was, my father, I guess all these things have, he hated credit cards. He thought that was really not good for this country. And he's right. There's too much debt. You know, I'm not going to get political, but there's just people. He says, if you don't have the money, you don't buy it.
So I'd be interested, what would you tell that business entrepreneur today? Because, again, Kevin, we see a lot of people in financing, and
definitely
debt is something that people talk about. What's the lesson, or what would you say to somebody who's starting today, particularly if they're skeptical and saying, well, that was then, and this is now, and this is the way to do things. What lessons would you give them, because you're still continuing to do it?
All right, they would say that they might say, well, sir, you're too old or something. But people go in over their heads. I mean,
they're recommended to go over their heads. Right. They say you have to.
I think that's where they get in trouble, and a lot of good ideas don't go forward. And then,
so how did you balance? How did you saw new ideas, you saw growth that you wanted to do, but you did not want to go into debt to be able to do that. How were you able to, again, strike that balance and yet still be able to continue to have years and years of growth?
Wow. Just I guess if we couldn't afford it, we weren't going to do it. I mean, we've tried a lot of different things. We might try some ancillary products, but, you know, our basic product are our mattresses and the various pads. So,
but if there's a newer machine or new material that's going to be a big capital outlay that we want to buy, we don't just think about it one day and buy it the next. We start saving up for it.
Yeah,
and true.
If you know, we know how it's not a secret how much is going to be. We start planning for it. Do we need it? What, you know? Let's justify it, the cost and the return on that investment before we write the check.
I just love that philosophy altogether. It's going back to the forward thinking, the planning. I mean, that's how American companies were supposed to be built and made, and now it's the whole system's turned on its head. That makes so much logical sense.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not the norm. That's not the norm.
No, we're not going to be billionaires. But we're not a public company either. So we kept it private. That's something for my graduate business class.
But also, let's talk a little bit. You said you have about 40 employees.
Plus outside, what they call outside sales reps. What do we have, about
12 to 15.
So, and sounds like some of them have been with you quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some leadership or management philosophy that you think has also contributed to your success? Because it takes, to have a good product, you have to have good people. And again, what do you think some of your secret sauce is there, Alan?
Well, we'll look at what people are, some of the employees are making, and if we kind of see something that doesn't look right, or this looks crooked, or this doesn't fit, we'll say, they know that, would you buy this product at the store? If you won't buy it, why? How do you expect the consumer to buy it? So there's mostly self-inspection. Oh, we're not perfect, but we get very, very few returns. And most of the complaints really are consumer misuse or freight damage. Which is that's an issue too, but we take care of the problems. If someone says they're not happy, we don't really have consumers calling, but when they do, if they do, we'll take care of it the best we can. Try to go through the dealers, but if the dealers won't help them, we always do. So the bottom line, the person making the product or the person, there's a lot of inspection stations all throughout the process. I don't know. It just comes naturally. It's just kind of like putting your shirt on.
But actually, when I was doing the hiring, when I was the plant manager, I would tell people from the very first day, if you see something that doesn't look right, I don't care if you've only been here 30 minutes, you tell somebody, you know, point it out, go, you know, get somebody. We don't want something bad coming through. Now, granted, our average employee has been there over 10 years, so it's not like we have that many new people.
It's a good track record right
there.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right, that's very rare in American manufacturing anymore.
Well,
like I said earlier, it's like you're doing everything very logically, and it's the opposite of what all the other American manufacturers seem to be doing. So, but I mean, everything I look at, it's like just that's the way it should be done. No one can argue with that.
Well, thank you.
You say, I'll take that.
No, and we try to buy, you know, I can't tell you, we've been offered foreign manufacturers. Well, why don't you make it in China, for example? I said, I don't want the employees. I don't think they can make it as good as us. Maybe they can make it cheaper, even if they can make it to our exacting standards. But then again, I just don't want an employee to lose his job. His or her job.
And that's one thing that I've always been taught, is that nobody should lose their job because the company's not selling enough. So that's one of the things that motivates us. I mean, you know, these folks that work for us are part of our family almost, and we want them to be able to provide for their family.
And you guys hold yourself to a certain standard, and it's not about the bottom line like it is in a lot of companies that'll say, well, we didn't reach the bottom line, so these people, we're going to cut them.
Right. We still have to be profitable.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's a company.
Yes, it's right. Not. Because we didn't make another dollar less, yeah. You have to go. That's no.
Yeah, there's been, over the last few years, there's been a lot of ups and downs. I mean, the economy is what it is.
It's a company. You gotta,
And I'm curious, since you have been around for a while, a lot of people that we're talking to, they had challenges during the, whatever you want to call it, the Great Recession. How were you able to, or did you continue to grow during that time as an organization, or was that a time when you sort of, had sort of level sales and were sort of biding your time and getting ready for when you knew the economy would ultimately come around?
Well, in the middle of that Great Recession, I don't know if anybody thought it would come around. But I don't mean to mislead. There are some big challenges, and still are some big challenges, because a lot of our longtime customers in retail stores have gone out of business mm-hmm. over the last few years. And that's been a tough thing. I mean, these people weren't only customers. They were friends of the family. We talked about lots of different things with them. And it's very tough when they go out of business. So we've had to go and look for new markets and sell a little bit differently than just to a true mom and pop shop.
Did you all ever think about retail on your own?
Not really. It's sort of, you're either a manufacturer or you're a retailer, and we're not in the business of just having someone showroom our products.
Okay. Well, if we were to be talking to your grandchildren, Dennis, what's the what's the trajectory, or how do you see growth for Colgate Mattresses over the next 10, 20 years? What do you all sort of have your sights set on?
We just want to be around, I guess makes us a little bit different. We've never said we want to grow, 20% over X period of time. We just want to keep doing the best we can possibly do and keep taking care of the customers and keep making the best product for the baby, and the rest will fall in line.
I actually love that because, like you were saying, a case study, that sounds like you've grown out organically, and that's what has worked for you, and regardless of what other people might do, you sort of stuck to what at your core has made you successful. The family, the quality, the forward thinking, and doing it organically. And it shows that, at least to me, as I'm listening to your story, that you have to know what's right for you. And once you get that, don't be swayed to do things just because it's necessarily the popular thing.
Right. Today, it seems that integrity and honesty are in short supply in our industry at large and in our particular corner of the industry. I mean, competitive claims, claiming environmental and toxins don't always hold up to strong testing, and we walk a fine line not to use scare tactics to sell our products. So we do walk that fine line.
Yeah. So talk to us a little bit as we begin to wind down. I know you aren't a retail store, so someone listening to this that decide they want to go buy a Colgate mattress won't necessarily be able to walk to the manufacturing plant on Ponce. But talk to our listeners a little bit about if they didn't know who you are but now do, how they find you in the stores.
Well, we're in most mom-and-pop stores that are still, and there's still quite a few independent retailers that are out there. We are in the one chain store that we're in is Bye Bye Baby. We started selling them when they were two brothers with one store, and we continued to grow with their business and showed them that as a small company we could handle it. Just because we weren't one of the big companies, we could handle it. We are in Amazon as well, which that was a tough decision between the family. I mean, but it's kind of the way you have to look at changing things. So But there's a full list at our website of where you can buy the small. It's much easier to tell the quality of our product at going into the actual store. But we know the reality of today's consumer is some of them never actually go and shop. So.
Right. Well, if you have a name in the industry, people may, the people that buy Amazon, I buy a lot of things off of Amazon. If they hear about you through word of mouth or by your reputation, that may have them feel like they don't actually have to come in and touch it. They know it's going to be what they want it to be when it hits your door.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Alan, as you are, again, thinking about this sort of legacy of the business that you've built, if you were going to be talking to someone who was starting out today and you were going to give them sort of those three pearls of wisdom, what would you tell the entrepreneur starting today, particularly one that is going to be in manufacturing? And I'm going to preempt and say, Dennis, I want you to think about sort of those three pearls that you would give someone who may be coming into, in this generation, a family-owned business, and some pearls of wisdom that you would give the son or the daughter. So, Alan.
So you put me in a position. I can't just slough it off and let him answer.
No.
Oh, wow. Wow. I think that you have to really want to be in business for yourself. You have to believe in your idea. I mean, every week you hear of somebody that's been tinkering in their basement and finally get a unique product, and all of a sudden they're able to sell it. And really, I know this new show, but Shark Tank is kind of an interesting, know, people start in their dens or wherever, or in a garage, such as Bill Gates did. So you have to believe in your product and think it's going to work, and always do your best. Don't just get a product out there and make a quick buck. Quick buck artists, they're gone, just like the old gunslingers. They're dead.
Yeah.
But
So one thing I take from that is stick with the fundamentals.
I think so.
Stick with
right?
the fundamentals.
And like I said in the beginning of the show, you start with the broom and just keep working and make sure. And to this day, I'll walk around the factory, the warehouse, and I don't like seeing any scrap of paper on the floor. Just keep it clean. You spend more time at work than you really do at home almost, and just you treat it like that. And if you build things from the foundation, you build it strong. If you build a building strong, you build it right, you can go high with it. So they don't build skyscrapers by just having a weak foundation.
Right.
Wow, what other pearls of wisdom to a young person? Don't give up. I know there'll come a time when, just like my dad, he's ready to give it up, because this was way before even single line telephones, much less internet and all that stuff. But
so persevere.
Persevere. Pay attention to your surroundings, your competition too. Buy right as far as your supplies. Pick your suppliers, but be loyal to your suppliers. No matter if you're making little toy trucks or making beautiful coats, make sure the quality, and don't cheapen your quality just because you can save 10 cents a yard here or whatever.
Yeah.
But just make a strong foundation and expect to work hard.
Okay.
I think even the ones that are the billionaires, they worked a lot of hours
to get where
they
are.
They stuck with it. And quick buck guys they're on those TV shows.
Not in real life. Dennis, what's your pearls of wisdom for our listening audience today?
Well, the first thing would be to have a father like mine.
Oh, gee, thanks.
It's true. But, it's hard to top what he just said. I'll just add to that a little bit. Try to work, especially in high school and college, work some different jobs in different industries and find the passion of what it is you want to do. in addition to that, go out on your own and try something, even if it's just mowing lawns or cleaning houses, whatever it is, you know. And actually, I did that. I forgot about that. I went out, saved up, bought a lawnmower, and started mowing some lawns, and then hired out my little brother to do a few here and then. But so you got to go out on your own and just everything he said, do your best and don't chintz.
Actually, yeah, do some other things. His little brother who works there now, and he's a big boy now, who has his own little family, but he actually went into teaching. He taught for 4 years in the public schools, and he expresses himself, and people gravitate towards him. And then he worked in he taught in the private schools for 4 or 5 years. So they all went out and did other things before they came back. And no skill, whatever skill it is, even if you can't even screw a screw in, but you had other skills such as teaching and relations. You know, customer relations,
right.
people skills. And my brother, who we really haven't talked too much about, he's a very smart person. I mean, he is, believe it or not, he is actually a PhD in microbiology, so any scientific things. But he went out on his own first before he came back. And somehow my father, he was asking my father what he should do. You know, my father says, you know, it's not a bad life.
Yeah.
Come back to the family. But all three of them were out in the public for probably at least almost 8 to 10 years. So, but they didn't get a free ride.
Yeah.
They started at the bottom. They started with the broom.
All right. Okay. Well, that may be, Kevin, the thing for us to remember. They start with the broom. You gotta know
that. That's gonna be his book when he writes a book. It starts with the broom.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
You want to co-write it?
You
can be my ghostwriter.
Well, we have. I think I can speak for Kevin. We have really enjoyed hearing your story, and I just appreciate what you just articulated. Is that it's been nice to hear your story as you're listening to each other talk, because you're probably so busy in the operations.
We don't get to talk like
that.
I don't know if you have much time, but I forgot to tell you. A few years ago, my father was honored by the Georgia House of Representatives. I brought the proclamation with me. I know, but it tells a little bit about this. It was probably one of the highlights of his life. They called him. He was 90 at the time.
Wow.
And he was called up to the podium with a Speaker of the House, and they presented him, and the whole legislature stood up and cheered. I mean, I almost cried.
Yeah.
So
that's powerful.
That was, and he had his, it was one other legislator that served in, that was still serving in the legislature, that was a World War II veteran, and the two of them, he asked our representative if he can take a picture with my father. So they were the only two. So
for those in our listening audience, you may never have seen one of those proclamations, but this is from March 19, 2008, recognizing Colgate Mattress Company. So a nice tribute to your father, nice tribute just to the family and all that you all have been able to accomplish. So we really appreciate you coming in and talking with us today. And so join us every Friday at 10 o'clock where we talk about all things growth. Because let's talk about it. Because
growth matters.
All right.